Hello, this is Helen Disney, co-host of the Financial Markets Insights podcast, which is brought to you by the Realization Group. Here we bring together the best minds in the financial and capital markets industry to discuss all the latest trends and news. Today's podcast host is Jan Apache. In episode 3, she'll be talking to Hiranda Misra, chairman and CEO of GMEX Group, about the spectacular rise of the SPAC, or Special Purpose Acquisition Company. Why have SPACs taken off so massively over the last year? Is the trend set to continue? And what does it mean for the traditional initial public offering? We hope you enjoy the show.
SPACs, or special purpose acquisition companies, have been around for many years, but recently they have started garnering major attention as well-known investors leading SPACs have been raising record amounts of money. In 2020, there were 255 SPAC initial public offering worth $79.1 billion, or £65.6 billion, according to Refinitiv. This compares with 94 deals worth $14 billion in 2019, and just 16 in 2016. And the first weeks of this year alone, there were as many as 179 deals, raising $56.1 billion. Investopedia defines a special purpose acquisition company as a company with no commercial operations that is formed strictly to raise capital through an initial public offering for the purpose of acquiring an existing company. They're also sometimes known as blank check companies or backwards IPOs. In a typical IPO, a company announces it wants to go public, then discloses further details about its business operations before investors are willing to purchase their shares. A SPAC essentially reverses that process. A group of investors pool money together and the SPAC goes public as a shell company, so the investors don't know what their money will actually buy. Disclosures are simplified because the company is simply a financial vehicle with no day-to-day business operations to disclose. Some analysts worry the SPAC boom is one of multiple signs of a market bubble, along with the GameStop phenomenon and the rising price of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. So why exactly have SPACs become such a hot trend, and will this boom within a boom, with some similarities to the initial coin offering craze, really benefit investors, or is it all just hype? So what are the pros of SPACs? SPACs are partly sparking so much attention as a result of the market volatility created by the global pandemic. Under these uncertain circumstances, a SPAC's inbuilt features of speed, control, and certainty for founders who want to go public became a lot more attractive. And the trend has now built on its own hype. As influencers and famous names have got involved in SPACs, including in hot sectors like fintech, ESG, electric vehicles, and digital assets, others have been encouraged to jump on board the SPAC bus too, if only for fear of missing out. Famous SPAC holders now include former professional basketball player Shaquille O'Neal, former House Speaker Paul Ryan, noted investor Bill Ackman, and last year, a 25-year-old even became the youngest ever self-made billionaire, all thanks to a SPAC. One of the common elements between initial coin offerings and SPACs is that companies acquired by SPACs can often be highly speculative, with unproven business models and little or no existing cash flow. Both risks and rewards are high. Modern SPACs do have a better reputation than the blank check companies of the 1980s, many of which were fraudulent and whose consequences eventually led to new regulation. But even so, detractors argue that SPACs circumvent the IPO listing process and that this increases risk for investors, even though SPACs are still covered by securities regulations. Sponsors who organize SPACs are often generously rewarded with equity when they close a deal, also leading to concerns about conflicts of interest. Will unscrupulous sponsors simply merge with any company, regardless of quality, in order to get their payout? Perhaps a better or broader question to ask is not why are SPACs on the rise, but rather why is the IPO in decline? The listing process for and the involvement of an investment bank as facilitator and underwriter in an IPO is cumbersome and expensive. The need for regulatory compliance and board oversight makes high growth companies less agile, meaning that many choose to stay private. SPACs go some way towards addressing these dilemmas. Many companies are also looking to the US, where investors assess companies differently, focusing more on forward valuations and the quality of the management team and less on traditional measures such as profit and loss. Even though there has been a huge growth in SPACs in 2020 and 2021, as measured by Refinitiv, only 11 of those took place outside the US. Yet despite all the SPAC frenzy, perhaps investors should pause and consider that even though SPACs are garnering all the headlines, traditional IPOs have still outperformed SPACs in 2021, according to recent data published by Bloomberg. The US has, until recently, attracted the lion's share of SPAC deal flow, but could all that be about to change as the SEC contemplates an accounting rule change that could have a dampening effect on the market? Forbes recently reported that the US government is likely to change the classification of SPAC warrants from an equity on the balance sheet to a liability. This would affect not only the benefits for future investors, but also mean that the many SPACs that are currently active would be forced to restate and refile all of their financial statements. The uncertainty has already caused a cooling off of new deals. As for Britain post-Brexit, the UK government is considering carefully how best to promote the nation as a fintech and technology hub. SPACs are one obvious way to attract high growth companies, and as a result of Lord Hill's UK listing review, the UK is now looking to reform its listing rules in three key areas. Given UK investors' more cautious approach to company valuations, combined with financial regulators' slowness and lack of flexibility in enacting reforms, the question now is, will the UK and Europe be able to keep attracting high growth companies, or will the upsides of the SPAC boom mostly accrue elsewhere? Miranda, thank you for joining us today. You've always got an interesting opinion, so I'm very much looking forward to this conversation with you. I know that SPACs are something that you're particularly interested in as well, given the nature of your business and the primary and secondary market side of things. So what's your view on SPACs? Are they a good thing? Many people don't know that bank-led and underwritten IPOs are just one way to get a stock exchange listing. We've seen that direct IPOs, such as that of Coinbase recently, and SPACs have always been around, but they've just grown in popularities lately. So what issues have we seen in the traditional IPO process and market that have led to the rise of SPACs and, to a lesser extent, direct IPOs? And yes, are SPACs a good thing?
Yeah, very good question. I mean, the big issue with IPOs is that they take a long time and it can be, you know, daunting and expensive as a process and quite a stressful process for issuers to go through with a lack of certainty at the end of it. For a number of reasons, which we'll explore, SPACs have been very attractive to private companies, for reasons such as cost. You mentioned some interesting stats. I mean, underwriter fees for SPACs are typically 2%, and then there's a 3.5% fee on completion, according to certain data sets. But is by comparison 7% for a traditional IPO. So whilst there aren't a substantial difference in costs in percentage terms, you know, in a high value deal, that can be quite tangible. Equally, the other thing is the time to market, because the structure already exists with a SPAC and the cash within it. I mean, typically, a SPAC deal can take 3 to 4 months to complete. Once an acquisition target is identified and post due diligence, the trigger is pulled. I mean, for an IPO, it can take up to a year for that process to run through. And in hot sectors like high growth technology, a lot can change in any given year. And as you rightly cited, the numbers in terms of SPAC deals that are coming through and the growth in those speak for themselves in terms of the interest in this area.
Thank you. And what are some of the advantages of SPACs for both investors and for firms coming to market?
So SPACs, in essence, at a high level, they represent a faster, easier, and more certain route to the stock market. Unlike an IPO, the target price, the listing is agreed much later on. Here, actually, the target company and the SPAC must agree on a fixed valuation at the outset. That limits price volatility and again provides more certainty. Those detractors might cite that, SPAC might receive a lower valuation than going through that kind of IPO process. And ultimately, you've got to pay the sponsor fees for SPACs. But in essence, once once that company is acquired, the SPAC starts secondary trading. I mean, market forces will decide what the valuation is. And sometimes on an IPO, if the valuation is overly high, that leads to a reduction in the share price on opening anyway. So, you know, that balance is important to get right. You know, the other thing which you mentioned, you know, is really important. You know, SPACs are good for high growth companies. Why? Or companies with potential high growth, because ultimately the way that financial technology and broader kind of high value technology works, there is a large part of the valuation that is made up of expectation value and future valuation. And typically it's not about 3-year historical forecasts and P&L and EBITDA that may not necessarily exist. So this allows the story to be built around sectors that are hot. It allows investors to come in to those sectors early on, and it allows issuers, given the fast time to market, to take advantage of interest in that particular sector at any given time, so that you get the timing right. And sometimes, you know, the ability to raise capital, list, be successful, and grow the share price is all about timing as well, and being aligned to that. I mean, ultimately, the numbers do have to speak for themselves, you know, whether you go down an IPO route or a SPAC route, because you have to put runs on the board as far as revenues and PLL is concerned. And ultimately, you know, with SPACs, those that contribute capital into the SPAC have the power to, you know, effectively approve the acquisition or reject it as well. So, you know, there is a level of control even for investors that come in, even if, you know, it does take up to about 18 months for a target acquisition to materialize, you know, at the latest point, and then list as well. And, you know, this level of advantage makes SPACs very, very interesting in my view.
I guess picking up on something that you mentioned just now, you've got to take SPACs on their individual merits, haven't you? Because there have been some high profile stories of SPACs which are primarily known for their high profile backers and initial investors, whereas there are also the more positive stories of SPACs and the fact that in some cases actually a well-organized SPAC that's been carefully put together actually can have an ideal board to incubate a certain type of target company and really take it to the next level of growth, which is very important for growth companies, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you know, much like any investment, whether it's a SPAC or an IPO, ultimately investors coming in to that particular stock have to decide on the merits of that particular stock, you know, which includes a level of different analysis, including, you know, expectation value and you know, what they believe the future performance to be. Strength of management team absolutely plays a part. You know, again, with the SPACs out there, you know, the credibility of management team is equally as important as the target acquisition, because ultimately, you know, with that target acquisition, it's a merger of two management teams. Even if it's a de-SPAC, you know, where the management team of the acquiring company then come in and effectively run the SPAC company or its combined management team as well. You know, so track record is very, very important. You know, some detractors of SPACs cite that there's a level of short-termism here, and management teams of SPACs aren't that incentivized to find good deals because, you know, they'll get 20% at the outset anyway, and therefore, you know, let's get a deal done. But ultimately, you know, what must understand is reputations are on the line, you know, and reputations take years and decades to build, and they can be lost in an instant. So equally, you know, the credibility of the management team is important, and ultimately their interests are aligned because their own reputations are on the line as well.
Do you think that investors understand well enough what some of the challenges associated with investing in a SPAC are? And do you think they understand well enough what they should be looking for when they're seeking to invest in a SPAC, aside from high profile names being attached to them? What should they be looking for?
It's interesting. I mean, for investors, you know, I mean, one of the challenges around SPACs is cited as, you know, investors having blind spots because, you know, they're buying into a SPAC IPO ultimately, but they don't know the final acquisition target. And they've got to rely on the SPAC's founders and the managers to, you know, select effectively the best target company. But that said, you know, as we mentioned, they do have the option to go ahead or not. But actually, the fact of the matter is they might say, okay, there's an opportunity cost with that, because let's say it takes up to 18 months to select a target company. Yes, meanwhile, the money that they put in might be invested into US treasuries or, you know, get some other kind of return. And at the end of it, if it doesn't go ahead, they get their interest back. But there's a level of opportunity cost, because during that time, could they have invested that into other investments that were available there and then? And would they have garnered better return than interest that they get back? So obviously there's a certain trade-off there. But that said, when they invest in the right, or if they invest in the right target acquisition company, that can result in immeasurably higher rewards anyway. And so, you know, that kind of opportunity cost and risk reward, you know, it's a balancing act. And of course, you know, conflict of interest is cited. Yeah, of course, the founders are incentivized in terms of the SPAC deal and getting that done. But ultimately, you know, as far as we're concerned, I mean, there is a large degree of structuring required. As we know, with any high growth company, ultimately, they don't mind whether they're privately funded, they're funded via a SPAC or an IPO, as long as the costs aren't prohibitively high at the outset, and as long as they have certainty of funding as well, which is important, because high growth sectors and platform plays are capital intensive. So that said, you know, some of those challenges of SPACs are easy to overcome with really efficient structuring. And what I really like about them, you know, running a fintech company myself is, you know, that forward valuation metric and investors buying into the story is very, very important, because you know, we've seen some great unicorns created over the last few years. But certainly, I mean, even Amazon, I think it took them about 10 years before they made a tangible profit. And then now the stock's motoring, whereas sometimes with traditional IPOs, there's a lot of short-termism and it's all about kind of immediately putting runs on the board rather than building that ecosystem that then manifests itself into a broader play. And we don't always value that network value, you know, which is why the Facebooks of this world bought WhatsApp, and you know, there's been countless other acquisitions as well in this space. But the beauty here is, you know, all of a sudden you've got a listed company where market forces can then decide on supply and demand, rather than a private company that's much harder to value and it's much harder to get an entry and exit from as well.
And you mentioned there, you know, with companies such as Facebook, along the way they've discovered the benefits of potentially synergistic companies that they've acquired, such as WhatsApp and others. With SPACs, do we have the opportunity to actually do much more cool things from the outset? So, for example, having a SPAC with a defined strategy for acquiring multiple firms and, you know, becoming some sort of multiple entity or conglomerate SPAC or something like that, that basically has an acquisition strategy for multiple companies that it intends to bring together under some sort of united roof and brand from the outset. Could we see more things like that?
It's an excellent question, because, you know, ultimately, unintended consequences of technological development, we've ended up with more fragmentation now, with even more innovation and lots of new technologies, you know, whether it's quantum computing, blockchain, artificial intelligence, and you know, the Internet of Things. But there's a convergence of new technologies. But equally, all of a sudden, with traditional infrastructure, we've now got, you know, multiple blockchains and lots of silos, and lots of firms, you know, certain firms that might be focused on payments, other firms that are focused on exchanges, other firms that are, you know, focused on software and services. So certainly the way that fintech's becoming more global, the way that platform plays are propagating themselves, and we're seeing real network effect and value, this does lend itself to a broader roll-up strategy. I mean, certainly, you know, in terms of what we do on the exchange and market infrastructure side, you know, we've had approaches by parties to say, well, you know, you guys should be looking at SPAC as the year progresses. But actually ahead of that, you know, why don't you look at combining with this entity or that entity, because, you know, 1 + 1 can make 11. And certainly that becomes interesting if you then overlay, you know, the verticals that you may be in vis-a-vis other verticals, the clients that may be there, and ultimately the revenues and P&L that may exist. And ultimately with that kind of platform play, you end up overlapping kind of vertically and horizontally and reaching a much broader subsegment of the market. That tells an interesting story as far as investors are concerned, and a broader story, because it is all about joining the dots. And then all of a sudden, you know, with a little bit of roll-up activity, you end up with something that's much more valuable as far as then, you know, the SPAC IPO is concerned as well. And, you know, this is a trend that we'll see more of, in my view. And it also leads to ultimately higher valuations, kind of high level of capital being injected, and a much more broader ecosystem as well. So I'm all in favor of it.
I really like what you said there, because one thing that stands out for me was mentioning that, you know, you've already been approached by potential investors who said, why don't you do a SPAC, but why don't you join up with these types of companies as well? And to me, that indicates a level of strategic thinking that we often see missing from the equities markets over the past couple of decades, where there has been a trend towards short-termism. So could SPACs actually encourage a revival of more strategic thinking from the outset and more purposeful investment?
Yeah, it's really interesting, because they can encourage that and also encourage innovation, because the issue that you have, I mean, often, you know, in recent times, we've gone to some of the larger exchanges with a really innovative play and said, okay, you know, why don't we consider a joint venture on this? But actually, you know, again, that joint venture might translate into huge enterprise value and huge revenues if you take a five-year projection. But actually in the short term, you know, if we look at the next set of annual results, it may have a negligible impact. And obviously everyone's geared towards pushing up that share price and effectively, you know, in the short term, as you rightly said, putting runs on the board. And we've gone too far that way, but it stifles innovation, because innovation is always is about taking a forward view and making a call. And then, you know, as we know, the bane of every entrepreneur, you're always looking for capital, but also, you know, you've got to put in the hard yards and burn the midnight oil and build up that business and scale it, you know, from the ground up. So I think, you know, SPACs really give us the opportunity to do that. The other interesting trend related to that, and certainly there's been a rise in private equity SPACs, because, you know, private equity firms need an exit in one shape or form. You know, there could be a trade sale, you know, but ultimately an IPO could provide a really nice exit to investors as well. But, you know, SPACs provide a much easier route to do that. And certainly, you know, that's interesting, because a lot of these private equity firms are sat on interesting assets that they can then synergize, you know, with that roll-up strategy and then start to extract value out of them. And certainly the way SPACs work, you can start to do that at you know, a much earlier stage. You know, you don't have to go through Series C, Series D, E financing. You can really start to think about that, you know, as you head into Series B and beyond, because you've got tangible revenues and you'll fast accelerate into Series D, you know, beyond that as well. So I think this opens up a much broader capital pool. It opens up the ability even for some of the founders to at least, you know, potentially, you know, they want to be vested going forward as well, a lot of them, I'm sure. But it also gives a potential partial exit route, or in some cases an exit route. You know, that can only be, it can only be a good thing, because there's optionality there.
And what's the role of regulation in all of this? The, you know, the classic question. I want to take a slightly different spin on it this time, which is we've seen that there are actually clear benefits when it comes to strategic thinking and innovation and potential for realizing better value that can arise from SPACs. We've also seen that some are very speculative and, you know, maybe highly dubious in origin. So what role can regulation play in finding that balance between the two, encouraging the positive aspects whilst discouraging the more negative aspects?
It's an excellent question. And you know, some of the detractors of SPACs have cited the fact that, you know, it's a very quick shortcut route to market and you don't dot the I's or cross the T's. But ultimately, you know, as you rightly said, you know, when you summarize this very eloquently at the start of this discussion, you know, securities laws and regulation play a part, whether you're doing an IPO in a traditional sense, or you're going down the SPAC route. Ultimately, investor protection and regulatory protection is afforded by that kind of securities law process wherever you're doing it. And that's the case whether you look at New York, you look at London, you look at jurisdictions where, as you said, you know, we operate a stock exchange like the Seychelles, that there's well-established securities laws. So I think you know, some of those kind of negative aspects are overbaked. Of course, you know, investor protection is important, but you know, there's a different set of rules for, you know, when you're doing a private placement to accredited professional investors, and when you're going down the retail route. And again, regulatory protection for retail investors is certainly there. Another route, you know, that we've seen recently is, you know, where there's wholly an institutional round, then some of those retail investors might be aggregated in some kind of special purpose vehicle that then invests into the entity as well. So obviously there's someone to manage that. So there's different opportunities here. I mean, I think regulation in itself is forever changing. You know, we're seeing that on the digital asset side as well. And, you know, digital SPACs are certainly an interesting phenomenon because, you know, that could potentially lead to new forms of capital, you know, such as now, given the increased price of cryptocurrency, such as Bitcoin, you know, holders are sat on cash value of Bitcoin, but they're sat on Bitcoin that they then want to diversify from. And that certainly provides additional forms of capital into a SPAC, and we're going to see more of that. It's certainly something with SETDEX, the exchange in the Seychelles that we have, that we're now looking into, given we've had approaches for that. In terms of changing regulation, you know, you mentioned it. Most of those SPACs that have happened in the US because US really likes forward valuations. You know, they don't mind them. They're very used to that from a fintech perspective. But goalposts can be moved and regulation can be changed. So in the US, obviously, the potential with the accounting rules changes to change the way that SPACs are viewed can certainly have an impact, but that also presents an opportunity in other jurisdictions. You know, recently, Chancellor Sunak in the UK mentioned that he wants to reform the listing rules, you know, which includes reducing the level of free float from 25% to 15%, allowing a dual class of shares, which is quite typical in the US, and more distinct refined regulation for SPACs to really attract these types of companies to London. So obviously, you know, again, we might see better regulation that's more supportive of SPACs in the UK, and certainly that could lead to more opportunity. Hong Kong and Singapore recently have said that they will be reforming their listing rules, and even though they're taking a slightly more cautious approach, they realize the potential that SPACs can bring in the ecosystem that brings with them in terms of those target companies. So certainly they've got this high on their agenda. And obviously smaller jurisdictions are also looking at this. You know, Seychelles, which I mentioned with us, looking to drive this because obviously from an offshore center, that's really interesting from the perspective of African acquisition targets, which is a hot fintech sector at the moment. So in that sense, I think, you know, we'll continue to see regulation evolve. But you know, we can learn lessons from the present and the past, but that can only be a good thing as we move forward, you know, because ultimately it's got to be about investor protection, potential upside return, and ensuring that whatever they invest into is credible.
Thank you, Hiranda. So it sounds as though, yes, there is a lot of hype when it comes to SPACs, but also they could actually be a real opportunity to reintroduce some of the strategic and long-term thinking and outlooks that have actually been missing from the equity markets for some time, and that go back really to the principles of what the equity markets are there for, to help companies grow. And I hope that that is what we see more of in the future. And that we see regulatory regimes that are supportive of that growth in a healthy and safe way for both investors and for the SPACs themselves. Thank you for joining me today. It's been a pleasure talking to you, as always.
Thanks to all our listeners for joining us. You've been listening to the monthly Financial Markets Insights podcast. In our next show, Helen Disney and Joyce Lai will be talking about non-fungible tokens, or NFTs, and what impact they're likely to have on financial markets in the future. Subscribe to stay informed of all our future shows, and please do leave us a review, as your feedback helps us to improve the show and increase our audience. See you next time for more Financial Markets Insights.